You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Wednesday, 8 July. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you loud and recorded from my apartment in Bromfontein Werf. On the show today, in chat to Chantal Marx, Omnia results, and suddenly everybody wants to buy Quantum Foods. Lise Botha, MD, Old Mutual Unit Trusts on ESG as the developing investment theme globally. Wandile Shalobo on locusts, Cape Town port delays, and food inflation. This show is proudly sponsored by FMI, a division of Bidvest Life Limited. Make your impact, protect your income first. The views and opinions expressed in this show do not reflect the views and opinions of FMI. Some morning headlines from MoneyWeb. Dis-Chem fined 1.2 million for its exploitative behavior. And Fin24, private healthcare sector pleads for financial help from medical schemes. Morning markets overnight in the US, we saw the S&P down 1.1%, NASDAQ off 0.9%, Asia also red, Sydney off 0.7%, and Tokyo down 0.4%. Commodities mixed, a bit of PGM greenness, but gold is the standout, back at 18.06. Rand lost 16 cents in the last 24 hours, trading 17.15, and top 40 opening call for about 0.25% green.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting to Chantal Marx. She's head of research at FNB Securities. Chantal, appreciate your time this very early morning. Omnia results out yesterday. I got to say, a good turnaround. I mean, you know, they did a $2 billion rights issue, about less than a year ago. And that really does seem to have fixed the company. Often a rights issue kind of leads to another and another. In this case, it looks like they've come right from a balance sheet. A lot of challenges still.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are lots of different reasons why companies would issue rights or would issue further shares. One of them would be to fix the company or to give themselves adequate headroom in order to reposition the company for growth. And as you rightly say, these are usually the rights issues that keep on giving. It's not like when you are issuing rights to buy something, for example, or to fund growth. But in this case, it's worked out quite well. I mean, obviously, there's been massive value destruction in Omnia. But I did a quick calculation yesterday morning. And if you factor in the rights offer, just prior to the rights offer, the share was trading at about 35 Rand per share. So including your investment now, you would have at least made about 18% because the rights, of course, were issued at 20 Rand per share. Investors in a better position than they were before. And from what I can see operationally, it does seem to me that they are positioning the company for continued growth, particularly the chemicals business, which was really the big drag on that company.
Yeah, a solid turn in chemicals. Still, I mean, a tough space. It's tough for everyone out there. There's a pandemic. That's never a fun environment to be operating in. Agricultural, mining, I mean, they're two important sectors in our economy. Agriculture, if we look at that Q1 GDP boomed, we're still eating. Mining, I mean, it's happening, I suppose, and I remember chatting with Peter Major. A lot of our mines are open cast, so you know, social distancing and the like is possible, but they remain a tough sector, a tough space to be operating.
Yes, I mean, both of these sectors are extremely cyclical, but because Omnia has always been a cyclical company, their management team should have the required depth to deal with cyclicality like this. For agriculture, if you just look at their outlook statement, they're still quite positive. They're seeing really good fertilizer demand. It seems as if we've had some really good rains so far this planting season. So it does seem as if things will be good there for at least another 6 months. And then in mining, I mean, inevitably, they would have been impacted by mining closures. But this all depends on commodity prices and demand for commodities. And from what we're seeing from the Chinese recovery, it looks better than anticipated so far. So even though the actual levels of demand might be slightly lower, it's not about to fall off a cliff, it seems.
That's a great point. And certainly, we're seeing commodity prices by and large hold up. Quantum Foods since came out yesterday. So, I mean, the backstory is what, about 3 weeks, a month ago, Zeta sold a 30-odd% stake in Quantum Foods to Country Birds. Now it seems everybody wants to own that share. In the last 3 days, 10% of the issued shares have changed hands. The stock is up 35%. Any idea what's happening here, aside from suddenly everyone wants to own a chicken business?
Yes, it seems as if everyone wants to own a part of a chicken business.
Yes, good point.
But not everyone wants to own the entire thing. So, I mean, Country Bird Holdings now owns approximately 31%. They bought the stock at 5 Rand from Zeta. It was trading at 4 Rand at the time, mm-hmm. So a nice value uplift for Zeta, but still a reasonable price, 5.5 times PE odd. And then what we saw is from the SENS announcement yesterday is that they actually did think about buying the whole thing. So they approached the CEO about 2 days after they bought the stake from Zeta, and they made a buyout offer. But 2 days after that, they withdrew that offer and decided, you know what, we're happy to just have a stake in this eggs and chicken business and not have the whole thing. But we have seen a lot of speculation around Country Bird Holdings possibly taking out the company. And that has fueled, I reckon, a bit of the exuberance in the share price. But what Quantum has also said is that someone else, not Zeta or Country Bird Holdings, is also looking to acquire a stake in the company. They're looking to acquire 32%. And I had a quick look at the shareholder register. There are two chunky shareholders in there, institutional shareholders in there, and that makes up about 14%, which means that this third party, unrelated to Country Birds and Zeta, had to actually do a lot of footwork in order to get a 32% stake or commitments to sell 32% in this company. On top of that, they're saying that other parties, unrelated to Zeta, Country Bird, and the party that wants the 32%, is also interested in the company, but they also don't want a majority stake.
So, and the important point here is 35%. If you cross that threshold, you have to make an offer to all minorities, and everyone is staying very carefully below that 35%.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that the main reason being that the valuation has now run ahead of them. So you don't necessarily want to buy out minorities in a highly cyclical company when it's trading on a PE close to 9 or 10, mm-hmm. Particularly a company like Quantum Foods, where the market and cycles and demand moves against it so quickly. Before you know it, the stock is trading on a 2 to 4 times PE again. So now would not be the time to take out minorities, but minorities are bargaining on a takeout. That seems to be reflected in the price at least.
Yeah, and to your point, taking it out at 4 Rand is one thing. Taking it out at where it closed yesterday, 6 Rand 50, a whole different story. Chantal Marx, Head of Research, FNB Securities, really appreciate your time this morning.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting with Elise Berta, she's managing director of Old Mutual Unit Trusts. They've got a new, in fact, a first for South Africa, an active ESG unit trust coming to market. Elise, thanks for your time. ESG, environmental, social, and governance, it really is fast becoming a major investment theme, not just globally, but locally as well. As I suppose over the last years, decade or so, we do sort of take a wider view at our investment actions.
Absolutely, Simon. What we've actually seen is Morningstar did some data for us, and they found that 95% of millennials are interested in sustainable investment. Morgan Stanley also said that we're expecting about $30 trillion of wealth to be transferred from baby boomers to millennials. So that's really exciting. And also in 2019, we've seen unprecedented growth globally in ESG funds to the tune of 20.6 billion rand. I think people are feeling that they don't just want to invest for profit alone anymore. They really want to invest for a future that matters. And that's definitely a theme.
Yeah, and certainly you mentioned millennials, the Gen Zs are coming through. And I can't help but think a pandemic probably plays into this as well. And there is strong body of evidence to suggest that, yeah, ESG does actually work. I mean, those companies with high scores do better as a business. I mean, this isn't just some nice idea. The evidence is clear.
Absolutely. They usually display stronger growth. They have better operational efficiency, stronger license to operate. Plus, you know, in a social context, it is definitely far better perceived. So I think the way is definitely paved for these type of funds to play a far bigger role in our future.
Hey, do we have hard metrics in order to measure? I mean, I imagine the governance is fairly easy. In South Africa, we've got King, and of course, there will be some global governance we can use. In terms of measuring sort of the social part of the ESG, how do we go about that? How do we measure that as a hard number?
There is a MSCI indexation capability that we utilize in the fund to basically score a number of things. For instance, your impact on the environment, your corporate governance, how do you go about that? How are you investing responsibly? You know, what is your social impact on the investing? So there's quite a hard quant score, but there's also some reports that we use on controversies. The last thing you mm-hmm. want to do is invest in a company that is fraught with controversies. And I think governance, especially over the last few years, have become quite under the microscope with a lot of people. So I think there is definitely hard evidence, hard matrices that we're using, and we use that in the new fund we've launched. But obviously, there will always be qualitative aspects that we look at as well.
Okay, so there is some qualitative coming into it as well. And I imagine from a fund perspective, you've got a universe of stock. You then score them on that ESG, both MSCI, the qualitative as well. And I suppose you don't just then necessarily buy the highest. It's going to be a blend of, you're looking for a certain level of ESG score, and then you're still looking for good companies that have good investment cases at the right price.
Absolutely. So we utilize the score, and basically also something that's very important. It's not a pure green shoots philosophy. So we are peer cognizant, and we look at companies usually that outperform the ESG peer group by about 20%. In this fund, we're also very, very passionate about carbon emissions. So mm-hmm. we're trying to lower that carbon emissions by about 40%. And then obviously there's also a risk management matrix where we look at turnover sector tilts, because you do want to have a little bit of a broad-based investment universe, especially in South Africa, where we've got quite a concentrated basket of companies on the JSE.
Yeah, no, fair point. I mean, a last question. We you mentioned sectors there. Do we find certain sectors locally or even globally that perhaps sort of, I don't know, more easily comply to ESG, or the other way around, some sectors that seem to struggle? Or is it really a level playing field that if a company wants to, you know, be environmental, social, and governance, they really can get to it? It really is more about just a board and the willpower of that board.
It's definitely the willpower of the board, but needless to say, there's also different metrics. Environment, you can also imagine social. So obviously, with mining companies, you've got some things that you need to consider compared to their peers. But definitely, if there's a will within a management company and within a board to make a difference on governance, on social and environment, they are definitely at bay to do so. And we're definitely seeing far more effort coming from companies in order to do that.
I think it's great. I think it's an amazing trend. I think environmental, social and governance, as I said, it's been a big mover of the last decade or so. It's going to continue. And I think probably at some point, if not in my lifetime, it'll just be accepted. At least it would no longer be a reason to interview you, with no disrespect. It'll just be one of those things we take as a given as an investor.
I sincerely hope so, Simon, because I find it always fascinating that we as humans always are worried about plastic mm-hmm. and, you know, our own, you know, electricity. And then when we invest, we don't necessarily apply the same metrics. So I'm definitely hoping that will be a trend going forward.
Yeah, that's a good point. We take it from our home lives. Let's move it into the bigger investment world as well. Liz Boerter, Managing Director of Old Mutual Unit Trusts, talking ESG investing. Really appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting with Wandile Shlobo. He's a Chief Economist, Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa. Wandile, appreciate your time this early morning. We're seeing locust plagues, and I can't believe it's 2020 and I'm using that phrase, but it really is happening sort of north of us in the continent of Africa. We're seeing some in Asia as well. How much is this potentially a direct threat to us down here on the southern tip of Africa, in that locusts might start moving more south, or are they going to stay fairly localized where they are at this point?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Simon. I do think that at least for at this time, we're still relatively safe on the Southern Africa side, because all of the indications that are coming from our local scientists are indicating that they could stay up there on the Eastern Africa region. But if they were to come into areas, say South Africa, I do think that we do have some bit of expertise from the ARC. Something of somewhat similar to this in the early 2000s, and they were able to cope with it. But I do think that also the fact that East Africa have been struggling with these since last year, so South Africa also has had a bit of time to look into this, and we have expertise on the agrochemical side and the pesticides industry, which I think we'll be able to spray at a relatively better level than what we're experiencing up north.
I actually forgot about that early 2000s. It's a great point you make. Obviously, it's devastating crops in East Africa. Does this have implication perhaps for food prices, in a sense that they're going to need to find their crops somewhere? They're going to go into the global market and potentially push maize and the like prices higher.
Yeah, that's where the fear is actually at, Simon. You will remember that countries like Kenya, for example, were in any way in a situation where their agricultural sector was relatively fragile. Mm-hmm. Now, data pointing out that more than 500,000 hectares of land in area has already been affected by this in the East Africa region. We already, for Kenya, thinking that they will have to import this year about 1.3 million tons of maize. So if the locust spread in a much wider area, we could see those numbers going up. So far for Ethiopia, we still think that they are slightly balanced than the other countries, but this will really depend on whether they are able to control the second round of the spread of the locusts in that area. But certainly the food security issue is a worry for everyone as we look and watch the developments in that region.
We're having a fairly good crop locally. Is that a market we could potentially supply into if demand required?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're having this year, for example, Simon, about 2.7 million tons of maize that we could put to export markets. That's up 89% from last year. So we're looking at the East Africa region, thinking that if they were to need more maize than what we're already anticipating in Kenya, obviously South Africa would be one of the countries that could supply. But there's always a challenge there on a regulatory side, because remember, South Africa, we produce about 80% genetically modified maize. So we're struggling markets, but I do think that if push comes up, they might have to look to us. But I think even if they're not looking at us, global maize production is expected at a record level of 1.2 billion tons. So there is a lot of grain out there, wheat, maize, soybeans. So those countries might access that. But the challenge is always the fragile macroeconomic conditions when one has to import during these years of the pandemic.
Yeah, I hear you on that. Bring it back local. A lot of reports around Cape Town Harbour. They've had closures due to positive COVID cases in the harbour. That's resulted in some significant delays, some shipping lines adding surcharges to Cape Town. Is this impacting, I'm thinking particularly our Western Cape, agri exports? There's the whole fruit business down in that. Are they struggling to export out predominantly into Europe, or they're managing the port delays in Cape Town?
Yeah, I mean, there is a cost perspective that is being added now and some bit of delays. It's unfortunate we're experiencing all of these challenges there. Some of the volumes are diverted down to the Eastern Cape, but as you rightly said, adds to the cost of the transport on that. So that's the challenge for South Africa now. And one hopes that in the coming weeks or so, things could start to normalize somewhat there. But it's certainly a challenge logistically on pushing some of the product. But I wouldn't necessarily say we're at a critical position, but it's just a challenge that now people have to move goods to the Eastern Cape, added costs, slight delays that are involved into that.
Yeah, at least we've got that Eastern Cape Harbour. I thought of Durban, which is a logistically much more of an issue. It's much further away. Last question for you. A lot of anecdotal, and I stress the anecdotal part, around sort of food price increases over the last couple of weeks and months. Are you seeing anything in that side? I mean, certainly if we've got a surplus, I would imagine not, but maybe some sort of constraints in supply chain. Are we seeing food price inflation ticking into the system?
Yeah, we had a little bit of that at the start of the lockdown, which is what perhaps maybe what we saw it recorded on the data when we were looking at the April data. But I think that when one looks through, say, for example, from June numbers that are yet to come out of inflation and going through at the end of the year, we'll really see a subdued pace for the year. We have food price inflation at 4% for South Africa, and the key products that we'll be pushing that are relatively meat, but all of the grain and the fruit one will really be subdued. So I would say for the year, relatively better year on a food cost side in South Africa because of those large harvests.
Wandile Shlobo, sir, really appreciate your expertise. He's Chief Economist, Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa. Thanks very much for your time this morning.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
That's it for today. You'll find the podcast every morning from 7 a.m. at moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app and wherever good podcasts are aggregated. Chat to us on social media. Use the hashtag MoneyWebNow. This show was proudly sponsored by FMI, a division of Bidvest Life Limited. Make your impact. Protect your income first. The views and opinions expressed in this show do not reflect the views and opinions of FMI. A massive thanks to my team, Eddie and Caldora, and to you for listening and my guests for their early morning contributions. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.